This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl. This week we chat coffee poos, been there, testosterone and brain transplants. I'm Lucy Smith, let's do it. Hey, we got Savio from Preston Savio. Who is going to kick us off. Sav, you got a question about earthquakes coming off the back of what went down this week.
Yes, Dr. Carl. My question is, we're all aware of volcanoes and earthquakes. They usually happen during around the Ring of Fire. That's probably because they're on the border of two tectonic plates. Now, Australia is placed right in the middle of its own tectonic plate called the Indo-Australian Plate. So I'm just wondering, why did the earthquake happen so specifically in Sunbury as the epicenter? Because they're not, I mean, Australia's not in between two tectonic plates. So I'm just wondering why the earthquake happened there.
Ah, very good question. So you're right, the Earth surface is divided into a dozen or so tectonic plates, maybe 5 to 30 kilometres thick, which move across the surface of the Earth at a rate your fingernails grow at, 5-10 centimetres a year. And if you look at a bit of Africa and a bit of South America, you think, oh, gee, they fit together. And they used to in the past. The Atlantic Ocean is like a winking eye that opens and closes. And at the edges of these tectonic plates, you're dead right, Dr. Sav, this is where you got the big activity. They can either run into each other and buckle upwards, like to make the Himalayas, or they can run into each other and one goes underneath the other, and in this friction you get earthquakes. And you're quite right that one boundary is New Zealand, which is a long way away from Australia, and then the other boundary of the Indo-Australis plate is in India. And so we're in the middle. Okay, this is how you think about it. The tectonic plate is not like a solid lump of steel. Think of it like a biscuit. And so when you put some stress on it, if there's a weak point in a biscuit, you're applying stress on the outside, and then suddenly a bit halfway through or a third of the way through crumbles. And that's how come we can have earthquakes in the inside the tectonic plate rather than only at the edges.
Right. So there could be a possibility that in the future, the Indo-Australian plate could divide into two.
Oh, that I don't know. We'd need to speak to a geomorphologist. And if any of them are available, please ring. What's the magic number?
Text 0439757555. Thanks, Sav.
Thank you, Dr. Sav.
Thank you.
We've got Mason in Gippsland here. Now, Mason, this sounds like something from a sci-fi movie. What's your question?
Hey, doctors. Yeah, it's quite an interesting one. I was reading my four-year-old daughter an anatomy book last night before bed. We were talking about brains and a question popped into my mind about brain transplants, and if brain transplants were possible, would someone who received a new brain have all the thoughts and addictions and a behaviour and memory and education of that donor?
Yeah, it's kind of like you've got a car and it's just screwed, mate. So you just jack up the windscreen wipers and then roll a new car underneath and put the old windscreen wipers back on. Is it the same car? Yes and no. The thing is that the brain itself is a continually changing dynamic thing, and people will say, oh, he's changed from 10 years ago, or after he had his heart attack, he became a different person and was never the same afterwards. Or if they've had, for example, long-term Parkinson's disease, they're different again. So who you are is a mixture, and how you behave is a mixture of what's intrinsically inside you plus all of your memories, and then how you use that to interact with the world around you. So even just the shock of having been through the brain transplant would change you. There is a saying with the intensive care people that if you've been in intensive care with all the pipes in you and on a ventilator for one day, I think it takes about a year or to recover.
Wow.
You're not the same person. Even something as simple as the machine is breathing for you and all that sort of stuff. Mm. So almost certainly they wouldn't be the same person. And I can't see how you transfer memories, but that would be for a genius rather than a person like me to discover.
Stop.
Darling, you're too kind.
Okay.
So, good on you for looking after your four-year-old daughter and teaching her all the anatomy. And here's something weird. You ready for a really weird thing to tell her?
Go for it.
Okay, so say, hey, darling. Do you call her darling?
Yes.
Yeah, say, darling, I weigh this many kilograms and I've got about 50 kilograms of water in me. Each day, the amount of water that crosses the internal membranes in my body, because there's all sorts of membranes, is about 50,000 litres. It's a volume of a backyard swimming pool. Wow. So on the outside, me, your daddy Mason, I've just got skin and I look fairly boring. But inside, I am this dynamic maelstrom of whirling activity who loves you. Oh,
that's amazing. Yeah. I'll have to write that down.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, and this weird anatomy stuff, start with that one.
Mason, I'm sure she'll get it as well.
Oh, absolutely.
We got Lex on Ewan Country. Lex, you've got a question about hand sanitizer.
Oh, hey. Was it the electricity one, though?
I know nothing.
Hang on. Let me double check that one. You want to know about, oh, yeah, electricity.
Lay it on me.
Yeah, true. So, okay, I install electricity meters, and I was wondering, I have this voltage stick and it tests voltage proximity and it's beeping like when it's quite next to my face in the air, like there's voltage and current floating around in the air in front of me in my brain, like just where my face is. So I was wondering if the invisible voltage and electricity has any effect on the human brain, like, you know, how DNA replicates, any sort of synapses, something, anything that the voltage could affect you in any way.
Yes. So, yes and no. But yeah, but overwhelmingly, yes, theoretically, but no in terms of bad effects on humans. And let me guess, how much electricity in amps is a house allowed to draw? Is it like 80 or 100 amps of current they're allowed to draw?
Yeah, something like that.
Ballpark figure, right. Okay. So, in your body, Lex, you have got enough electrons moving to add up to the same current that a house is legally able to draw at a maximum, about 80 to 100 amps. The difference is that the house is around 220 volts, 230 volts, whereas in your body, it's not even a volt. It's about a tenth of a volt. But nevertheless, it's the same current. There's the same number of electrons moving. Okay, first thing. Mm-hmm. The electric fields that you that exist around you and the magnetic fields are not powerful. They cannot cause ionization. They cannot knock electrons off atoms. So in that form, they don't immediately cause cancer, like ultraviolet light causes cancer, comes from the sun, X-rays, gamma rays. But they will interact with your body in fairly subtle ways. And I'll give you an extreme example. There's a thing called cranial, the skull, the brain, magnetic stimulation. And you put these magnetic fields on a person's head, and suddenly, on one hand, they lose the ability for about three quarters of an hour to be able to do boring, essential stuff like, I want to catch the tram from here to there, but I've got to catch the 377 bus, and then I've got to wait. And you can't do that. But suddenly you can draw a horse, like you've never been able to draw a horse in your entire life. And then that ability fades after about three quarters of an hour. So there is that effect of super powerful magnetic fields having temporary effects on you. And it's also used for migraines and also for people with depression. But if you're looking at just the lower powered electromagnetic fields around you, what is the damage that we've been seeing in people that we've had them expose, these things exposing to people for like a century? Nothing. We're just not seeing it. We're just not seeing the cancers from the mobile phones with their non-ionizing radiation. And we've had them for the best part of a third of a century. We're just not seeing it. So there could be subtle effects, but nothing major. So read up on transcranial magnetic. I'm giving you some homework. I won't give you any homework. Any more questions, Dr. Lex?
Me? I have another electricity question. It's kind of weird. It goes into the field of more conspiracy theories.
Lay it on me. Is it harp?
It's that if you put mercury and spin it, it generates voltage and current. And if you put it inside a copper ball and up in a spire, up high in the sky, that's how you get free power. And then like all the cathedrals and old buildings are like the olden days, they all had these spires with copper balls in the air, and they reckon that they were generating free electricity for the people.
Hippie bull dust. Mate, electricity is so expensive that, and there's a whole different reason for that in Australia. Let's not even go into that. But and it's not renewables, by the way. It is not renewables. But if there was free power, why isn't it there? Why aren't we using it? There are so many people who have written to me over the last quarter century saying, oh, I've got this great idea for a free power thing. I said, great, build it. And because then you'll have free power and you can sell it. No, I need somebody to build it for me. Mate, build the thing. Okay? If they can build it four centuries ago, we can build it today. Build it and get your free electricity and run your reverse cycling air conditioning to keep you warm in winter, which is gives you a efficiency ratio of 6 to 1. You know, hippie bulldust. I'm sorry they lied to you.
Wal in Rocky, what's been going on? You've been watching the sunrise with your wife, which is gorgeous, obviously, but you've noticed something. What's up?
Well, we've been trying to watch the sunrise, but it doesn't always work out as planned. We like to watch it on the beach, and by the time we get up and active and down to the beach to watch the sun come up, there's consistently a line of clouds on the horizon, which kind of stops us from actually seeing the sunrise. And I just want to know if there's a reason for it, or are we just consistently unlucky?
Ah, do you ever have a clear view of the horizon?
No clouds occasionally, yeah, but not always.
Okay, so here's something I learned from politics. Weather, all politics is local. So your weather is local, so you want to find out what's going on around you. So one way is a website called either Windy, W-I-N-D-Y, or Null School, and they give you the wind velocities around the whole planet. And down at the bottom end of Australia right now, there's this cyclone that has broken loose from Antarctica. So in Antarctica, we'll come back to Rocky. In Antarctica, there's this continuous wind going around Antarctica in a clockwise direction with half a dozen cyclones. And one of them, the circle of wind has expanded, and one of them is kissing the bottom end of Australia and then coming across from Western Australia over to the East Coast. And so there's going to be a bunch of rain. So in the same way, there would be something happening up in your part of the world, in Rocky. So you need to get the overall idea of what's happening there. Then you need to tie it in with the season. We need a meteorologist up in that area to call us. So, in other words, what's happening is that you're getting local effects going on. Now, part of it is that you can try a different location, but I strongly suspect you're going to have to go north or south a couple of hundred kilometres. Another thing you can do is change not the weather but your mind and embrace the clouds. There are many different types of clouds. You can love the clouds and also patience. You just have to wait for another 6 months. But the bottom line is that a meteorologist will be able to tell you why you're consistently getting clouds out to sea. I'm not that person. Sorry, okay. I failed you there. I was off to a good start,
no
then
worries.
I failed it, fell over at the end.
I love that that's a lesson. Well, love clouds and be patient.
Yeah.
That's it.
Sounds good to me.
We got Anthony in Byron Bay here. Now, Anthony, you got a question about testosterone. What's going on?
Well, specifically low testosterone and the long-term effects of it, please.
Ah, okay. So, overwhelmingly, you want to see a GP about this. If this is more than just a theoretical thing, and they can then bounce you onto an endocrinologist, et cetera, et cetera. Secondly, as a background, both men and women make male and female sex hormones in different ratios, and these ratios change during life, and they also change with your fat content. So, a lot of fat can then decrease your testosterone level. So there are many background things. So the main one is the obvious one is the sexual dysfunction, bearing in mind that Frank Zappa said your main sexual organ is your brain. And so if your brain is thinking, sex, then you can keep doing things. You can feel tired. You can have changes in the mood. Decreased muscle mass is a problem, and people will take testosterone specifically to put on extra muscle, and they can put on like half a kilogram of muscle in 2 days.
Wow.
Oh, my God. It's just but the price you pay is you're mucking around with a whole bunch of systems, including the mood changes and so forth. Changes in bone density. So with low testosterone, you can end up with, porous bones and maybe stress fractures, and low testosterone testosterone can also lead to where the fat is carried in your body. But overwhelmingly, go down a pathway, if it's a personal thing, of seeing a GP and then maybe the endocrinologist or whatever. Is that sort of a bit of a background?
That's sort of a bit of background. And with the replacement therapy or treatment, some of the symptoms or outcomes are very similar.
Yes. It is kind of weird. So on one hand, you can say, well, I'm going to take some testosterone and that will switch off whatever testosterone production I have or reduce it down, and then I'll be stuck on taking testosterone for the rest of my life until I die. But if you've got high blood pressure, you're stuck with taking high blood pressure tablets for the rest of your life until you die, and improves the outcome between then and when you die. So it's a complicated thing, and it needs to be sort of run through with your GP.
All right. We've got Nixon in Newey. Dr. Nixon, what's your question?
Hey, doctors. I'm just wondering how physicists know so much in the immediate time after the Big Bang.
By looking at the world out there, and so the non-European astronomers did a huge amount of work without glass instruments, you know, without telescopes, and that data then came across to Europe around the time, and before they had telescopes, beginning with Galileo. He didn't invent the telescope, but he's one of the first to use it. And then they started expanding their view of the world and the universe around us to realizing very early on, and the Greeks had sort of come to the same conclusion, and some of the Indian and Chinese astronomers, that the Earth is not in the middle of the universe, but rather in our local area, the sun is the big guy, and we're orbiting around the sun. And then when we got bigger and bigger glass telescopes, we were able to look in the sky and see fuzzy things. And there's a thing called the Andromeda Galaxy, which is a fuzzy thing you can see in the night sky. It's about, you know, half the size of the moon or something. And it took telescopes for us to be able to see that it was actually a galaxy like our own. So beginning in the 1920s, not only were we able to see these galaxies, we then were able to measure the light was changed. Now, have you ever seen an old-fashioned sodium street light? They used to have them before they had the white lights because sodium was really cheap to run. And it was a sort of a ghastly colour, but it was cheap. And if you look at it through a spectroscope or even like a little triangle prism like on the front cover of Dark Side of the Moon, there's in sodium there's two lines, if you look at it on a spectroscope, which are really close and they're really specific. And then they would, for example, look at a distant star and they would see that they were seeing these same two lines, but they were shifted into the red. Now, I'm making up the example of sodium just because it's easy. It wasn't sodium, it was something else. But the point is, they could then see that the light was shifted to the red color, and this was kind of like a Doppler shift. And then they started coming up with, the universe is expanding, so we're in the 1920s. Then pigeon poo comes in the 1950s. There's a couple of radio engineers working for Bell Telephone Laboratory trying to make quiet telecommunications from across the Atlantic, and they had a big fat dish, and they could get good radio communications across the Atlantic by bouncing signals off the ionosphere, but there was always some background noise, and they tried to get rid of this background noise, and they put it down to being pigeon poo on top of on their antenna, and they went and even scraped the pigeon poo off, and what they were listening to was the noise from the early universe at 380,000 years of age. So they were still working towards it. So these are these clues that are being given to them along the way by looking at the universe. And so what happened was that the universe began with a Big Bang, and people have been talking about this, especially some religious Jesuit astronomer people were big on this in the 30s. And the universe expanded, and then all that happened was that the core, within 3 minutes, the cores, the nuclei of hydrogen and helium were formed, but it was way too energetic for electrons to stick to atoms, and that happened at 380,000 years of age. At 380,000 years of age, suddenly all the electrons, the universe cooled down enough, all the electrons could stick to the hydrogen and helium. They were the only two atoms in the universe, and suddenly radio waves could run free, and they were picking that up from 380,000 years after the Big Bang.
Wow.
So this is the pathway by which they slowly built up their knowledge. So we can back up. I should probably stop here. Is that a bit of a start for you?
Yeah, no, that's good. I think it was, just when it happened so many billions of years ago, when you hear physicists talking about fractions of seconds after the Big Bang, whether it's temperature changes or fundamental forces occurring. Like, it's just, yeah.
It is weird. And people will say, were you there? How did you know it happened? These are the anti-evolution people. So I'm getting a lot of anti-evolution hate on one of my recent TikToks, which was on the topic of, if humans were accidentally just wiped out magically, could they ever come back again? And the answer is possible but unlikely, because there are all these weird mutations. So the thing is, we weren't there, but we've got stuff that's coming towards us. Read the book The First 3 Minutes. It's about 30 years old, and it's a little bit out of date, but geez, it's a nice, easy explanation, and that'll get you started. The First 3 Minutes, dealing with the first 3 minutes of the universe.
Dr. Carl is with you, chatting science as per on a Thursday. Martin in Canberra, read the clouds at sunrise question. He said the clouds at sunrise are caused by the land breeze, which is the nighttime equivalent of the daytime sea breeze, caused by different land and sea temperature.
Ah, yes. Is that it? Yeah. So in Sydney, we've got a three-way weather pattern where the ocean tends to stay at the same temperature, but the land goes up and down. So what happens in the early morning, the air is cold on land. The land is cold in the early morning, but the ocean is still the same temperature. And therefore the ocean is warmer, and therefore the air above the ocean rises. Mm. And it's replaced by the air from Sydney, which in case is sort of like Richmond, which is sort of to the north of Sydney. It comes in and it causes what's called an offshore breeze, which the surfers like, because it makes the wave a nice shape. Around the middle of the day, the breeze drops down to middle, nothing, because the land and the ocean are at the same temperature. And then in the afternoon, the air over the land is warmer. The land is warmer. It changes the temperature more quickly. So to the south of Sydney, down at Camden, the air is fairly cool, and you get this triangular wind that goes from the ocean over to Camden, carrying all the pollution of the day. And Camden's one of a really lovely looking country area, and it's full of all the pollution from the rest of Sydney. It's got all this asthma. And then between midnight and dawn, the air then runs along the coast from the south to the north. So it goes in this big triangle. So that's another part of the whole weather pattern.
Jimmy in Cairns. Dr. Jimmy, you got a question about lifting weights.
Hey, doctors. Just wondering, when lifting upper body, a leg might shake sometimes. I'm just wondering if it's the body or the mind causing that.
Mm. Oh, my God. I can answer that to some degree, not very well, if it was the muscles that you were using. So if you're lying on your back and you're doing a chest press, a bench press, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's it, yep.
Okay, so you're definitely using your upper body, and you might have your sort of legs braced against something, but they're not the main object of the muscle work. And yet you're saying, is it one leg or both legs that get the shakes?
Just the one.
Definitely don't know. And I've actually had this happen to me in the past, and I should have rung up you to ask you, Dr. Jimmy. But, okay, if someone's got an answer, please ring in. We want somebody who's an exercise physiologist as to why an unrelated muscle will get the shakes when you put and you're pushing yourself in with the bench press, like, up to your maximum, aren't you?
Yep.
Okay, right. So with maximal effort at one end of the body, why does stuff at the other end of the body get the shakes? Please ring in exercise physiologist. Thank you very much. We might have an answer for you.
0439757555. Hey, earlier in the show we had a question about low testosterone. Han in Nam, you've kind of experienced both ends of this spectrum. What's going on?
Yeah, so I'm transgender and I've been on testosterone hormone replacement therapy for 2.5 years. I think it's a really important part of the conversation when we're talking about testosterone and remembering to talk about us as well as, you know, cis guys that have any kind of hormone imbalances. Like, we go through all the same stuff, and it's like so cool. We can experience male pattern baldness if the genes are there. You know, same with that muscle and weight distribution. We get real hairy, same as anyone going through male puberty.
Okay, can you talk more about the muscle and weight distribution with regard to upper body and lower body, especially muscle and fat? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so from my understanding, once you're on testosterone, it can take a while. For some people, it can take a few years for this to start, but you'll have fat that, you know, for women, I guess we'll say, is typically stored in like the hips and the thighs and the bum. That over time will shift into the belly.
Right.
Yeah,
and the muscle, did you actually do muscle work along the way, or did it just happen without you doing any muscle training at all?
So it depends. A lot of people, it can vary from person to person, but a lot of people that I get a bit jealous of are very lucky and can just put the muscle on. They don't have to do a lot. Same with a lot of, you know, cis guys. They'll go through puberty and suddenly, without even doing that much, they've got a lot more muscle. But it is easier to put on muscle as well. You don't have to do as much work as you previously did a lot of the time.
Mm. I saw a great TikTok with someone who transitioned to male and, you know, they were so stoked, but at the same time they began having a receding hairline, Han, and they were like, damn it, you know.
I know. And that hasn't hit me yet and I'm crossing my fingers.
Oh, well, thank you so much for this different perspective as well, Han. We really appreciate it.
No worries.
We've got Justin in Wagga here. Justin, we love sleep questions. What do you want to know?
My question is just why sometimes when you get 10 to 12 hours of sleep, you wake up feeling absolutely bogus, but sometimes you get maybe 3 or 4 and you wake up feeling completely energized.
Mm.
Happens to me quite a lot. I'm just curious.
Okay, so the first thing is it's really important to have a good night's sleep, and sometimes it's just not possible for the sort of work you're doing or just how you've accidentally been set up in life. It is worthwhile going to a sleep laboratory. On average, 8 hours of sleep a night will make you feel better, have a better life outcome, be more reasonable, you know, cure sunstroke, syphilis, varicose veins, hand, you know, it's good, okay, if you can. With regard to not having enough sleep, you can go into a reflex mode, which I don't fully understand, where for the first couple of hours you are firing, but then later you hit the wall, metaphorical phrase, and then you begin to fade away. On the other hand, I don't understand why people, when they've had, say, 12 hours sleep, will sometimes feel really exhausted and just out of sorts. I do not know what's going on.
Mm.
And we need a sleep scientist to tell us. There's some in Sydney, some in Adelaide. Please ring in. You know who you are.
Justin, me and Bryce have even had conversations about how sometimes the shows where you've had the least sleep beforehand can sometimes be your best because you're weirdly running on some sort of adrenaline or flight or fight.
You just
don't care. You're kind of a little bit looser. It's very interesting.
Okay, and just to be
definitely
clear there, people will say words like adrenaline and dopamine and endorphin, you may be wrong. There's something going on. We don't know what it is. For example, you've heard of the runner's high. Mm. Only in the last couple of years have we discovered it's nothing to do with endorphins. It's rather your natural cannabis chemicals.
Ah.
So when you say the name of a chemical, it's maybe not the right name, but you got the right idea that there may be a chemical somewhere in the universe that's involved.
So it's not adrenaline.
The runner's high seems to be
cannabinoids. When you're tired and you feel like you can...
It sounds like it should be, but knowing how complex the human body is, it could be anything. Like just remember this. We don't know how anesthetics work. We know how to use them. The body's too complicated. I'm wussing out.
So weird. We got Megan in Geelong. Megan, what's your question?
I am just wondering, when we add sugar to cement, why does the cement take so long to set with the sugar in it?
Ah, so the sugar thing is related to the fact that cement has to... Okay, so cement is a short word and concrete is a long word, which is how I remember that cement is the gluey stuff that you use to make concrete, right? And so when you add some sugar into the cement, you're stopping an essential part of the process. The essential part of the process is that it's got to go through a hydration process where it loses water and sugar grabs some of that water and stops the hydration from happening as quickly as it should so it can delay the setting process. And also, because it's not the regular chemicals, it turns out that you end up with a slightly weaker concrete, but you can specifically add in sugar in small quantities to make it workable for a longer period of time. Now, concrete can end up in a whole range of grades, from like your domestic laid on a path that you're doing yourself because you just bought some stuff at the hardware store, all the way up to what they call blast grade concrete, which is used in underground bunkers around the world. And if you're going for the top strength, you want to keep the sugar out of it. But in many cases, you can put the sugar in and improve the time you've got for laying it. But it does weaken it because it interferes with the chemical bonds that happen. And also it slows it down because of the hydration. It slows down the dehydration process that the cement has to go through.
That was my next question. Does it weaken the cement?
It can, yes. A little bit. It interacts with the calcium silicates, and they. I'll give you a new word, not absorb, not B for Bravo, but D for Delta, adsorb. And that means that they sit on the surface, so the sugar molecules sit on the surface of the calcium silicates, and they don't go deep, they just sit on the surface, and it stops them from interacting with each other properly and with the water, and so the hydration thing takes longer, and it's a little bit weaker on average.
Chris and Matilda in Port Macquarie, what's your question?
Hey, so I'm actually ringing up on behalf of my six-year-old daughter, Matilda. We recently, about 4 or 5 weeks ago now, moved into a new house, and we took the rubbish out on the first night, and she's looked up in the sky, and this one in particular star was just, it was almost like a strobe light of red, blue, and the white, red, blue, and it looked like maybe a faint green. I thought maybe it was a plane, but over the period of the next 3 weeks, taking the rubbish out every night, roughly around the same time, the star was still there. It was still really powerful, but now it's just at the stage where it's lost all of its colour. It's just a normal star and it barely flickers anymore.
Ah, in the early stages, when you saw the flickering and the colours, was it low on the horizon?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so if you look straight up into the sky, straight above you, you're looking at what they call an OAM or optical air thickness, OAT, of one. You call that one. But when you're looking across to the horizon, you're looking at maybe 20 or 30 times more air molecules.
Okay.
And air is pretty transparent, but if you're looking at a distant horizon, you can see the colours change and so forth. And so it's acting as a bit of a lens. And then if you've got the air moving, then you have different densities of air, and this can cause the flickering. The astronomers have a term for this. They call it the seeing, S-E-E-I-N-G. And you'll say to them, what was the seeing like last night? And they'll say, oh, it was great, or it was crap. And it was still the same amount of cloud cover, which was zero. And what happens is down at ground level, you get these columns of air, maybe 5 metres wide and half a kilometre high, sort of roaming across the countryside. And if they happen to go between you and the star or the object you're looking at, then it will interfere with the seeing. If it's on a horizon, you'll be seeing more of these, and then that will cause the change in density. So you'll see fewer stars on the horizon because the fainter ones are blocked out by the extra optical air magnitude, the air thickness. But on the other hand, the ones that you do see are more prone to the flickering, and you were very lucky to see the colours. Lucky you. Wow.
Yeah, well, at first we kind of stood there thinking it was a plane or something, but it didn't move. And yeah, like I said, for 3 weeks it just stayed there, but slowly. And now it actually has moved a little bit higher than when we first seen it.
Ah, mate, you've started your child off onto a good pathway of asking questions.
We've got Chris and Matilda right there. Di in Queensland. Di, what's your question?
Can you clean broccoli by soaking it in vinegar? And if so, of pesticides and chemicals and things.
I exhale there because this has been all over my TikTok feed. Just so many people washing their vegetables and this is how I wash and that's like ASMR. Dr. Carl, do we need to do this?
Don't know. Probably not. On one hand, we're living in Australia, one of the wealthiest countries on earth. We are as wealthy as Russia. We've got as much GDP as Russia. We can't make anything, but we still are very wealthy. And there should be standards that the amount of pesticides left on the fruit and veg is close to zero. Now, then you've got two situations. Either they're water soluble or they're more soluble in acidy type water, hence the vinegar, or they're more soluble in alkaline type water. I don't know. Or they could be fatty residues. My knowledge on this at the moment is zero. There are pesticide residues. They're supposed to be safe. And which sort of liquidy stuff is the best for taking it off, like a detergenty one, which will take off the fats, or the acid or the alkaline? Definitely don't know. You've started me off on some homework.
Di, have you seen the videos where they put baking soda and they put vinegar in? And then they're like, look at how much this is bubbling up. But it's going to bubble. That's what happens when you put baking soda and vinegar.
So one is alkaline and the other one is acid. Oh, my God. Okay, we need to get some hard science and some data. So I'm guessing, luckily I do read Australian Potato, but they don't talk much about this.
Well, let's do one last one from James in Bangalore. James, you got a question I think we all want to know.
Dr. Lucy, Dr. Carl, my question is, what is the scientific relationship, if any, between coffee and inducing poos?
First one is that coffee's got caffeine, and that just increases general activity in the gut, everything from the small intestine to the large intestine. Secondly, it causes in the stomach, a separate organ, the production of gastric acid, and then that triggers the release of the hormone gastrin, and then that kicks the movement along and gets things moving out of the stomach faster. Increased peristalsis, where that squeezing motion like a tube and you're pushing on it, that happens as a part of caffeine. And then finally, at the other end, it actually does stimulate, caffeine does stimulate the rectal muscles, causing them to contract, and then that causes an increased urge. So what have you got inside there is being squashed, and you're thinking, oh my God, it's under pressure, I've got to let it out. It is real, you are not imagining it, it is a real thing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Science with Dr. Carl, and a big thank you for your questions every week. We've been getting into some of our favourites via Triple J's Instagram and TikTok, particularly one that's come around pretty often off the back of a recent TikTok trend. It's all about how can a mirror reflect something it hasn't technically seen? Maybe it's hiding out of view, maybe it's hiding behind a piece of paper. Dr. Carl dispels this over on our Instagram and TikTok right now. So go and check it out. Give us a follow. This episode was produced by Lou Hill. I'm Lucy Smith. We'll catch you next week.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.